I'm Jason Klom, and this is the Comedy on Vinyl podcast. Hi, everybody. Jason Klom here. There's no particular album, year, or artist. We've got a lot of different things to cover, but my guest is Jim Turner. Thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you for having me.
I should say Jim Turner of Duck's Breath and Two-Headed Dog. What else? Arliss. We just talked about Arliss for 2 seconds.
Girly Magazine Party.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, yes.
Clowntown City Limits, which are all... Actually, Clowntown and Girly Magazine Party are both Two-Headed Dog. They're under the umbrella of Two-Headed
Dog.
Yeah,
okay. Right. Did the Hef thing come by naturally? Was that just, I kind of sort of remind myself of Hef?
No, not at all. That was... I used to collect old Girly Magazines.
Mm-hmm.
Really weirdo ones, you know.
Uh-huh.
Black Stockings and just weird crap. Satan. There's a magazine called Satan. But these 50s and 60s, and they just had a great, like, weird, we're trying to figure it out. And then Hefner came along and kind of stole the thunder. He figured out how to do this.
Yeah.
And I was a big fan of those. And I always wanted to do something with girly magazines.
Mm-hmm.
And then... I used to watch Playboy After Dark when they reran it. I actually saw a few when they initially ran it in the late 60s, early 70s. And Hefner was just the worst. He was the worst clumsy, clunky host. He didn't know what to do with his hands. He didn't know what to do with anything.
Uh-huh.
And I loved watching him because mm-hmm. he was so bad at it. And I tried to imitate him. And then one day I was thinking, what can I do with these magazines, blah, blah, blah. And I went, why don't we do a thing, a girly magazine party?
Yeah.
And it was actually, girly magazine party was an old Duck's Breath bit,
mm-hmm.
One that I was not in. The other four guys did. And it was really pathetic, really pathetic.
Uh-huh.
And I just stole that from them. And I came up with this character, Tellus Wondersweet, and I found a suit that, once I found the suit, it was all,
yeah,
it was immediate.
Of course.
And when I do it, I'm trying to do my best. I'm not an impressionist
mm-hmm.
at all. And I'm trying to do my best Hugh Hefner impression.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all I was, you know, trying to do. I was trying to talk the way he talked. And the reason Hefner smokes a pipe, I did a lot of research,
mm-hmm.
was that he used to do a show called Stag Party.
Okay.
And... then they did Girly Mag, or not Girly, but they did Playboy After Dark, and there was a guy named Victor Lowndes,
mm-hmm.
Lowndes, who really was the Playboy.
Okay.
He was the guy that everybody at Playboy looked up to.
Okay.
Because he was the one out there, you know, making it with playmates, making mm-hmm. it with women. Just had the cool, it was super cool. And he said to Hefner when Hefner was on the show, he didn't know what to do with his hands, and it just was weird.
Yeah.
And he said, you need to do something with your hands. Here, hold this pipe and just put that in your mouth and just, you know, occasionally pull it out. But Hefner sucked on it so hard because he was so nervous
mm-hmm.
that it whistled. And he said, you have to smoke because we can't have this. And so he started smoking.
Wow.
And that's why, because...
what
just
a
to
nerd.
Cover this nervous... Oh, he's so nerdy.
What a nerd. That's amazing. That might be the most charming thing I've ever heard about him.
Yeah.
Out of tons of stories of the exact opposite. I mean, besides the whole free speech thing, just seemed like a creep. But I love hearing a nerdy story about Hugh Hefner and that you did enough research for your thing. I love that so much.
That's what, you know, we came... And the very first show we did was 1992
mm-hmm.
at Theater, and... I ask all these guys from Iowa,
mm-hmm.
Mark Feit, Dave Allen, the Higgins boys and Gruber,
mm-hmm.
And Dave Allen. There were others. And I said, let's just do an Iowa thing. And then it became Girly Magazine Party.
Mm-hmm.
And the first few shows were completely made up. We had no idea what we were doing.
Holy
none.
Crap.
We weren't drinking on stage then. We were... I don't know. We didn't have any drinks. Might have had fake drinks.
Okay.
And after doing it a few times, then we started adding, Mark Fite started making drinks. And then the shows got really weird. We built a kind of little set with a bar and chairs and these kind of chess piece backdrops. And we would get drunk, like drunk. And there was a show... And I actually kind of lost. I had to keep the show moving, you know, and it was just, what are you going to do? I'm going to be a so-and-so. Okay, you're going to be an astronaut, and you've come back from the moon or something, right? Yeah, okay. And then what are you going to do? I'm going to do this. And we would just have a list, and that's all. We would just so next up is, what's your name again? And I would ask them their name, and we would just sort of wing it. And Dave Higgins... I got so drunk at times that I would go, wait a minute, is this show just crawled into the toilet? I don't know if this bit has been going on too long or if we haven't even really started it. Like, I don't know where we are. And then one night, Dave Higgins was sitting next to me in a chair, and I turned to him. He played Professor Timothy Glendenning. And I turned to him and I said, and what do you think about that, Professor Glendenning? And the look in his eyes was like a teenager who this was his first drunk ever. And his eyes were spinning. Anyway, I'll be back. Got up and he left. And I went, okay, that was real. That wasn't shit. And he went off stage. And apparently at Theater, they had a toilet right off stage and puked. He was about to collapse.
Oh my God! People who listen to this show know that I once a month drink professionally on stage. So I've done that and seen what you're talking about, but so very rare. We have scripts. We're lucky because we're doing stage readings of movies people have seen a million times. So you can kind of fuck up a lot. I cannot imagine doing a full length improv anything as drunk as I've been on stage. Jesus,
that's amazing. No. We never. And when we do the show, Mark's making all the drinks, and there's people, Stephen Banks, Rob Elk, Toby, who don't drink.
Okay.
But we all have to look like we're drinking.
Yeah, yeah.
Because that's the deal.
Mm-hmm.
Dana Gould doesn't drink. And so Mark had to, you know, he carried two pitchers, and he had to know who just asked him, hey, Lance, can I get another cocktail over here?
Right.
And he would mix one up for Dana, but it wouldn't have any booze in it because some of these guys are like AA guys.
Yeah, sure.
And I don't think he ever screwed it up.
Wow. Yeah. That's impressive. You know, okay, so embarrassingly, I've been doing this podcast for 7 years. It took until I met Firesign's archivist for me to know anything about Duck's Breath because he's like, I'm a big fan of their stuff. You can't get their stuff anywhere.
This?
Taylor Jessen, who is Firesign's archivist. He's like, you can't get their stuff anywhere. I've had to go digitize all their stuff for myself because you can't get it anywhere.
Wow.
Yeah. And he, you know, I will say, gave me copies so that I could listen to them. And so it was very late into my experience that I got to actually listen to Duck's Breath.
Uh-huh.
So I'm wondering what your history is with the group, what the history of the group is, because it's not something we've ever really discussed at length on the show.
Well, with Duck's Breath, Duck's Breath came about in 1975 in Iowa City, and didn't mean to be an actor. I was always a class clown. I was always, because I moved every other year. We moved constantly. I lived in 10 houses before I was 10 years old.
Oh my God!
In 4 states, 2 countries, all over the place. Jesus. We moved.
Was this a military situation or something else?
It was a Air Force.
Oh, okay.
And same then my here. Dad got into radio. And I was a good class clown. I knew how to make people laugh really well. But I wasn't going to pursue it. I didn't know, how would you pursue this? Make people laugh? This was, you know, the 70s. So I got to University of Iowa, and this friend of mine signed me up to audition for a play. And I said, why would you do that? It was Man is Man by Bertolt Brecht. And Leon Martell was directing it. Terry O'Quinn, Terry Quinn, was the star of it, Gaily Gay. But I auditioned for it, and I said, why the fuck would you do that? I don't want to be a... Oh, my God, Kathy, that's... And I went, because I didn't want to make her look bad.
Uh-huh.
And I walked in, and this director said, "So, what are you reading?" Meaning, what are you reading for the thing? And I'd never auditioned for anything. I didn't know what he meant. I said, "What do you mean?" And he goes, "Are you reading? You know, what are you reading today?" Nothing. Was I supposed to prepare something? And he gives her a little like look, like, "Wow, okay, great, this is wonderful." And I said, I didn't know. And he said, "So, what are you reading right now?" And I said, "Last Exit to Brooklyn." He said, "Do you have it?" I said, "I do." Got it out of my backpack, and I just started reading. He just said, "Read."
Oh my God.
Thumb to page, read. Just read to me. And it was this really sick section, which Last Exit to Brooklyn is a very sick book, but it was this really sick section. And I read for 2 pages, and he went, "Great, thank you." Then cast me.
Holy shit.
And the second biggest male part in the play. And while doing it, I met these other guys. This Merle Kessler was also in the play. Oh. Leon Martell is one of the guys in Duck's Breath. Mm-hmm. He directed it. There wasn't a Duck's Breath at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And they got to know me, and they said, "Hey, we're doing a show in a bar, and you want to be in it? It's just a fuck around." And sure. And so we got together. It was called Cliff Notes Hamlet, and Merle was going to be Dr. Clifford Note. And Clifford Note was a guy who condensed everything, and then got a lot of shit from people because they were destroying the classics. Mm-hmm. And he was, and this production that we're about to show you is the proof that we're doing something really good. Uh-huh. And he put together all these academics, and we made up names and stuff like that. We had 2 rehearsals, and I just chose to be a wacko, professor who's mm-hmm. nuts. And I played Laertes and Gertrude and Ophelia. And I had 1 scene between Laertes and Ophelia that went back and forth. And it was like, it was all improv. Mm-hmm. Merle wrote the copy to introduce each scene.
Okay.
And on this scene, Hamlet, blah, 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 blah. And then we just kind of made stuff up.
Oh my God.
And it was done February 9th, 1975, in Iowa City. It was about 6 below. The bar where we did it, the Boulevard Room, was completely packed. Packed. You couldn't get any more people in it. And the Boulevard Room was the weirdest bar in Iowa City. It was a cowboy bar.
Okay.
And then, like, specifically cowboys, and then they were kind of nudged out, and the management turned it into a black bar.
Okay.
And it became, and in Iowa City, there's not a lot of black people, so they had their own bar.
Yeah.
Then a gay manager took it over, and it became the gay bar.
Wow.
But nobody ever gave up their territory.
Oh, holy shit.
So it was this, you walk in the Boulevard Room, there'd be like, what is this place?
Uh-huh.
I can't quite tell. And everybody kind of kept to their little sections.
Okay.
And so he asked us to do this, and it was huge, huge success. And right after the show, the manager said, "When's the next one? I need a new one. I need another show."
Uh-huh.
And Leon Martell said, "Yeah, we can do one. What's it called?" "Frank Iowa's Magic Notebook." Okay. And he said, "You guys want to do another one?" Sure. So we did another show in about a month. And then we started doing shows at all the different bars in Iowa City. And they started coming to us because nobody was doing this, 1975.
Mm-hmm.
We performed at the COD and the Boulevard Room and the Mill. Gabe and Walker's is where we ended up.
Mm-hmm.
And the manager for Gabe and Walker's, which was the rock and roll bar, wanted us to do 3 nights a week, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. And he said, "I want to charge 50 cents. And we were like, "No, no, 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 no. You don't charge for our shows. They're for free."
All right.
And he said, "Guys, this is ridiculous. 50 cents is nothing." And we negotiated with him. And so he dropped his beer prices down to 10 cents for a beer. So all for right. $1, you could come in and watch comedy. We did 3 sets and then repeated the first set at the end of the night.
Okay.
Watch 4 sets for $1. Drink 5 beers.
Yeah.
And we did a new show every 2 weeks. We were constantly rehearsing.
Oh my God.
and wrote tons of shows.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had to get out of Iowa City because it was like, okay, this is going to kill us. Mm-hmm. This is way too much work.
Yeah.
And we talked about going to New York, L.A., Pittsburgh. There was a guy who said, hey, come to Pittsburgh. My brother will support you guys.
All right.
Yeah, I don't want to go to Pittsburgh.
Very weird, but yeah.
And I'd been to San Francisco, and I said, San Francisco, man, there's tons of comedy.
Sure.
And I didn't like any of it, and I think we'll kill because nobody's like us there.
Mm-hmm.
I convinced everybody to move to San Francisco, and we honestly thought we were going to do one show, and it was going to be like, get the parade ready.
Of course.
Here they are. Oh, my God. They're saving us. And it wasn't. It was like years of living together in a variety of houses.
Uh-huh.
And all packed in. Girlfriends now. A manager. And eventually it sort of caught on enough that we could stop, you know, working temp jobs.
Yeah.
And just do shows. And then when we started doing radio stuff, Ian Scholes went on NPR and Ask Dr. Science went on NPR.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a regular thing. And then after that, we could go to any college town in the country, mm-hmm, where there was a college NPR station and sell it out.
Wow.
And everybody thought of us as this radio group, but we weren't. We were a performing group. So yeah. It was really, they were really surprised. Like, I don't know what they thought they were going to see, mm-hmm, but it was a pretty honed comedy show, live show.
Nuts. That's kind of the reverse. Well, it's the exact reverse evolution to Firesign, who were a radio group first and then moved on to doing so much live stuff.
Yeah.
Did Iowa City have a comedy scene, or was it just you guys? I don't know what it was.
No, I mean, there was no... Really, 1975, 76, there wasn't much of a comedy scene even in...
In most places,
like, when
right?
we moved to San Francisco, there was really only a couple places. I don't know if the Punchline was there or not, but mm-hmm, the Holy City Zoo was definitely there.
Mm-hmm.
And they were just starting to filter in.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't part of the stand-up scene, so I don't really know.
Yeah.
But there was no big sketch scene. There were some people like the Pitchells, you know, and there were improv groups.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of improv groups. We weren't really an improv group. We wrote our stuff, and we improvised when we forgot our stuff.
Yeah.
Same way with Two-Headed Dog.
Uh-huh.
We write most of it, and then we make up a bulk of it because we'd forgot what we were going to do. But we had the general idea.
Mm-hmm.
And the Duck's Breath was a lot like that.
I want to talk a ton more about this, but you were kind enough to bring records and recommend records, which let's talk about them first. And then why don't you tell me the ones that you think would be worth listening to right now?
Well, almost all of them are kind of unlistenable.
Okay. Okay. Love it.
This is called Mr. Tremendous Speaks. Everyone Listens. And I was in New Orleans,
mm-hmm,
going through used record bins, and I saw that. And whenever I find something,
mm-hmm,
at a junk store that grabs my eye, mm-hmm, I keep going past it. Like,
yeah.
I saw Mr. Tremendous Speaks, Everybody Listens, and I read it, and then I kept going. Mm-hmm. Like, okay, that's not the gold. That's the gold flake.
Yeah.
The real gold is going to be in about 5 records.
Mm-hmm.
But this was the gold that I found. And this is a Christian, you know, a speaker. What do they call those speakers?
Oh, my God. Yep. Mm-hmm.
What's that word?
One of those speakers that makes you feel good about yourself.
Yes, exactly.
My brain do it right now. It's a bad time.
Anyway, he talks in
motivational.
Here.
Motivational.
This
Jesus
was
Christ.
Yeah, motivational speaker.
Yeah.
And he talks in here about the new LSD, which is leadership service dedication. And I listen to this, and I now do Mr. Tremendous.
Really?
Two-Headed Dog does our own version of Mr. Tremendous.
Oh, my God.
And I stole 60% of it directly from him,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
and then I added other things that make
it
completely,
that's amazing,
fucked up. This is Gomer Pyle.
Yes, yeah, USMC. That's
and this has
there.
A song called Gomer Says Hey. It's the last song on side 2, and it goes, two young lovers on a front porch swing, boy told a girl that he brought a ring, hoping one day soon that they'd be wed. She said, fine, but I'd like to hear you whisper pretty love words in my ear. He took her in his arms and softly said, Gomer says, hey, hey, hey. Gomer says, hey. So Duck's Breath loved this record. Mm-hmm. We listened to the whole thing, and we did a thing called Gomer Says Hey, where Gomer came out, and I was Gomer, and Gomer came out, and he was going to solve a problem. And then another Gomer showed up. I think it was Merle played the other Gomer, and he showed up, and I was like, whoa. What are you doing? I'm Gomer. No, I'm Gomer. And they had a little, you know, I'm Gomer. And I can't remember how the rest of that bit went, but that was a good one.
That's amazing. This is an autographed copy.
Well, that's a fake autograph. Let me see the signature.
Okay, I was wondering because
that's our manager, Steve Baker.
Love it.
Wrote this.
Love it.
Yeah.
That's so good. That's why I'm never sure, because I found a couple that are autographed. I'm like, is it legit? Because anybody can sign a fucking thing.
And this is legit. This is an autograph. This is Richard Peterson. Richard Peterson is a Seattle street performer, and he plays the trumpet and this little piano, and he writes all the songs, and he plays them at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he was a famous Seattle street performer. I think he must be dead, because I have friends in Seattle, and I haven't heard about him in a long time.
Mm-hmm.
He was an older guy. He put out two records. He wrote his liner notes, which are so great. This is an excellent album. My second album. He says that to start that one, too. This is an excellent album. And it's just...
Oh, my God. That's phenomenal.
And it's just really odd music.
Mm-hmm.
And he plays all the instruments. And it's just kind of like... It has a very idiot savant thing going on.
Oh, my God.
Now, this is my favorite record, I think, of all time.
All right. Now, I will tell you, I did get to listen to some of this online. You can find some of this online.
Oh, that's so great.
So I at least got to find that. The other ones I couldn't...
You found music from another
planet.
Somebody
ripped part of it and put it on a very bad copy of it. It sounded like shit, but it sounds like it. Maybe it sounds like shit.
I am Howard Menger. And he's a sign painter. I mean, look at that picture of him.
Oh, my God.
Phenomenal. Shades. Why is he wearing shades?
Uh-huh.
And he's a sign painter from New Jersey. And he met people from another planet. And they took him into the woods. And he tells the first side of this record is his narration about how he met these beautiful, magical people from, I think, Venus. And they took him into the woods. And there was like a little house, and they went in, and there was a large piano. It was like a piano, but it had many more keys than a normal piano, and they played music for him, and he now has recorded what he was taught by them, and what it basically sounds like, you know, when you sit at a piano, I don't play the piano, but when I play just the black keys, you can kind of fake things.
You can
make it sound like kind of Eno-esque. You know, pretty ambient music.
Yeah.
That's what it sounds like, exactly. But him telling the story is so great. And this I got in New York City. My friend lived on 45th and 8th Avenue. And there was a place half a block away called the Flying Saucer News Bookstore.
Okay.
And it was run by this little teeny guy who wore this filthy white shirt, skinny little necktie. Completely packed. I mean, you couldn't really walk. There was just stacks and stacks of magazines, of books. And I went in there. I didn't have the money at the time. I spent almost $50 on this and a stack of books about the Hollow Earth. And there's all these books that are, you know, self-produced.
Yeah.
People publish them themselves. And I bought tons of them. About the brown Eskimos that live in the Hollow Earth. And some of them are really crude. They look like he probably made 5 copies.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they're hand... The covers are hand-colored.
Holy crap.
I still have them. And this, I bought this record.
It should be noted, this, like, the cover is pieces of paper, 8.5 by 11, just scotch taped onto the damn cover. Like,
literally scotch taped.
This is the way they would do bootlegs. This is the way that not even a vanity press is this bad. Like, this is, like, low-end... probably cut on, you know, some scrap piece of vinyl. This is nuts. And now I will say, now you're saying that there's only bits of narration, I feel like, in what was online. Like, if, is this like a full length album or is it just?
Yeah, there's two sides. One side has the music. Let's see. There was not enough online.
There's only bits then. It wasn't the full thing. So there's more for me to hear.
Side one narration. Let's see how long that is.
It's just so great.
Oh, he doesn't have any times.
Of course not.
The song from Saturn, music from another planet, as played by Howard Menger. In his narration on the reverse side, Howard Menger tells how this music came to him from another planet. It's amazing. That's what it says on the sleeve. And then this was narration by Howard Menger, noted lecturer and author on outer space flying objects and persons from other planets. And then there's a shorter song called Marla, and it's an instrumental. The theme from the song from Saturn, it's also an instrumental.
About what time did you pick this album up? Do you remember?
Oh, this was, Steve had just, I think this was 78, 79.
Okay, so it's in, you're still in the throes of being a comedy group. Does something like this, like, make you want to write more? Like, that's all I can think of. As I'm looking at this, I'm like, I want to make this exact album, but my version of it.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd never done that. And it's funny because a lot of these, like Gomer Says Hey, I did a thing.
Yeah.
Mr. Tremendous, I did a thing.
Mm-hmm.
I've wanted to do a thing of Howard Menger.
Right.
And I've never quite got the, because it's so ludicrous.
Sure, yeah.
But I'm glad you bring that up because I think I have to.
Yeah, it would be amazing. You know, I have to. Do you know Eben Schletter?
Yeah.
Okay, because my just first thought is theremin for an hour with you reading over theremin. That's just my first thought, and it would be delightful. Whatever you do with it, I hope you please do something with that. That's just phenomenal. Good God, I'm going to need to hear the rest of it at some point. I'm sorry. This is begging so many questions. There's just so much going on.
Isn't that cool?
Yeah, that's phenomenal. I love.
It's literally duct tape onto a white sleeve. In the back.
Uh-huh.
And then, you know, light from spaceship in the background illuminates person from another planet who emerged from the spaceship. These are pictures that he took.
There's the guy.
There's the spaceman.
I love it so much.
That might
so
be
much.
Marla.
I need to know if anybody knows anything about him. Like, I feel like that's a guy who might have died in obscurity, but then there might be some people who, like, have held on to his legacy in some way.
The full story of Howard Menger on the sleeve can be read in his forthcoming book entitled From Outer Space to You.
Holy shit. Oh my God.
He's made two cross-country lecture tours, has been received enthusiastically by receptive and interested audiences.
Wow.
He's given up his sign painting business. And that's the other great thing I forgot about is that several of the books that I bought were... The authors were also in the sign painting business.
What the hell?
And I can't remember if it was him or somebody is the one of the top sign painters in his... In 1947, he again met the Venusian woman who he had come to know upon at the age of 10. She told him many things about himself that somehow she seemed to know.
It's a very dense back cover. I just got a dense cover of an album. I mean, there's all this is we didn't point out. This is just two columns, mostly words. This weird photo of this cool looking dude sitting in front of a microphone.
That looks like
possibly
a like James Earl Ray.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean that is assassin written all over him.
He does.
Killer.
Uh-huh.
It totally looks like James Earl Ray.
This is occurring to me. So I've seen plenty of like Vanity Press stand-ups and Vanity Press whatever the hell this is. I've seen that stuff. I've got the only bootleg comedy album that I've ever seen, which is that Groucho thing. They didn't make too many. That was just a crappy collection of Groucho clips from about 74 or so. And they're great songs, but they're really shitty quality. I've never heard of or seen, and somebody will correct me, and that's fine, please do. I've never seen a Vanity Press sketch album, which is basically what I've done, you know, on CD. But, like, I've never seen somebody back in the day, because I feel like it takes too much. It's too many people, too much effort. Like, I don't think you can do a sketch album cheaply.
Yeah.
That doesn't seem possible, right? Because you can't have two or three guys in a room with no sound effects.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, that's what the Duck's Breath records are very... They're very similar to what, and we did sketch on these. This has our second album. It's got Either Way It's Fine With Me. My song is Randy. Real People of the Future, The Vatican Disco, Ask Dr. Science, Money is a Gun, Millionaire Boot Camp, Religion and Politics, Riches and Patriotism in a Cable Format. God, this was, what year was
that? Was that 86? Or was that
86?
80? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're
Invasion
dense.
Of the Mole People. That's 10 minutes long.
They're very dense albums. That was the one thing. Like, again, my friend sends them to me, and I'm like, this is 30 tracks. What am I going to do with this? But they go by very quickly. I mean, that's the bonus. Like, so if you've never heard a Duck's Breath album out there, they just keep going. They're very, 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 and they're, I will say, like, as a fan of Firesign, and I'm not trying to compare, I'm just saying it took me forever to get into Firesign because it's too much for my brain.
Yeah.
I was stupid when I was young. Something, this would have been palatable because it's small bits. It's my thing.
I honestly never got into Firesign. Mm-hmm. All my friends were totally into Firesign.
Sure.
And I would try to listen to them going, oh my God, what the hell is going on?
Yeah.
I forgot what's going on.
They're so dense.
I'm the same way with comics. When I was a kid, I loved DC comics because each frame was very clean.
Yep.
There was no weirdness going on in the background. There was a sky. There were buildings. There was Superman flying in the air.
Mm-hmm.
Marvel, I would look at Marvel comics going, oh, what's all this junk? There's junk everywhere. How do you know who you're following? And,
right.
And so I never liked Marvel for that reason. I like it clean.
Mm-hmm.
I like it simple. I don't know if I'm dumb.
I know. That's my curiosity, too, like, about myself. Because I'm like, every time I put together an album, I'm like, I got this real high concept. And I'm like, yeah, but if I do a real quick sketch that's like 3 lines long, I don't care.
Yeah.
I'm fine. If I can get in and out of the sketch in 3 lines, it's not going to be that complicated. Again, am I stupid? Please don't tell me. The internet, please do not answer that fucking question. How many Duck's Breath albums are there? Because I've listened to, I think, 2.5 of them now.
Well, there's two, but there's tons of cassette tapes.
Okay, so that's probably what I listened to. There's two plus some extra.
There's like 3 or 4 Ian Scholes cassettes.
Mm-hmm.
There's 3 or 4 Dr. Science cassettes.
Okay.
There's a cassette of our Western Senseless Cruelty that was just the live show on a cassette. I don't know why, we seem to hit right during the cassette phase, which there was a cassette phase. And yeah, we sold a lot of cassettes. I don't know if we completely missed CDs. We were way too early for CDs.
Okay, yeah.
Because I can't think of any of these being on CD.
You missed the CD era. So what is that? So Duck's Breath, when was the last release of anything that you did?
Shortly after this.
Shortly after that.
Because this was towards the end.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I moved from San Francisco in 87.
Mm-hmm.
And we still did stuff, but very rarely. It had to be like a special deal. Hey, guys, the Engler Theater in Iowa City wants to do a show. I'm in New York. I know, but we'll get blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, all right, I'll do it for money.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I don't remember what we released after that.
Mm-hmm.
We did do a 40th, you can get our final performance.
Mm-hmm.
We did a 40th anniversary show a few years ago. One of the wives of the Duck's Breath guys, Beth Ruscio, said, you know, your guys, the 40th is coming up.
Yeah.
40th anniversary. You got to do a show. And we thought we had done the last at the 35th anniversary.
Uh-huh.
And she said, you got to do one more.
Mm-hmm.
40th, come on. And so I put it out there, you guys, let's do one, but let's say this is it.
Because
really, it's time for it to be it.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody wants to be around for a 50th. That's just ugly. And 40th is nice. It's clean.
Mm-hmm.
40th. And so we got together for 2 shows. And the last one we did was recorded. Actually, they were both recorded. One was in Davis, California. at the Palms Playhouse, and then the very last one was at Freight and Salvage in Berkeley.
Okay.
Which was a funky, funky place. We used to do open mic nights when we first moved to San Francisco. And I mean, really funky. Like the stage was like 6 inches tall. It was in the corner. It was mostly folk music.
Mm-hmm, sure.
And it grew and grew. And then they finally bought this bigger space that was in Berkeley. And they got big names like Richard Thompson. They got, you know, big folk names.
Yeah.
And then they raised enough money to build a state-of-the-art place. It's got dressing rooms with showers, with perfect sound.
All right.
Perfect sight lines. It's beautiful.
Wow.
And we only did one show there, and that was our 40th show. My folks flew out from Des Moines to see mm-hmm. this. My dad hates flying now. He's in his 80s. And he said, well, Nan, to my mom, Nan, we got to go. And she said, you hate flying. He goes, I understand, but we have to go. It's the last one. Come on. So they flew out, completely packed. We filmed it. And then we filmed interviews that go, you know, throughout.
Mm-hmm.
And it's on iTunes. It's called The Grand Finale, Dutch Breath Mystery Theater Grand Finale.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really good.
That's awesome.
It's really good. We did one of the best shows we've ever done.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was just like we did a show the night before and there were many problems.
Uh-huh.
Also, the rehearsal process. We had 3 days of rehearsal. And the rehearsal process was like, at one point, two guys were arguing. It was just like the old days.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a big fight. And one guy stormed out and said, you know what? Fuck it. Fuck it. Who cares?
Shit.
Who cares? You know what? I wish we'd never said we'd do this.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're all kind of split up for lunch. And then we came back and they talked. Worked it out. So the first show was okay. And then the second show was just killer.
Yeah.
The only mistake that we made really was, and we can't do things physically. We were a very physical group.
Okay.
Lots of jumping up and down and things and roll. You know, we did this dog act where we're jumping over each other. We couldn't do that anymore. There was one bit where Billy Allard falls down on the ground. He's doing a Shakespeare thing and he falls, kills himself, and then couldn't get up.
Oh, no.
He had to crawl to a chair on stage on his hands and knees and then get up on the chair. And we started the bit. We started the whole night with us coming out. We always ended our shows with a bit called More Than a Box.
Mm-hmm.
And More Than a Box was a stupid bit where I come out with a box and the four guys are standing behind me and I go, hi, I'm married now and I got a wife and a kid and I start talking about this box and I got this box. I took it home and my kid was sitting on it. It was actually more than a box. It was like a little chair. Another time I came from work and then they slowly start chanting, more than a box, more than a box. And they're jumping up and down, more than a box. And they get louder and louder. And then it becomes like, you know, it was like a football. It was like a baseball. And we're miming all these things. And it was more than a box, more than a box. And it's very frantic and it's lots of high energy.
Uh-huh.
It's really dumb.
Uh-huh.
But it was a really popular bit that we did.
Mm-hmm.
So the way we started our very last show is, because I'd always wanted to do more than a box to start a show.
Okay.
But we never did.
Yeah.
And I said, let's do it. Let's start the show with this. But let's come out like in a walker and a hospital gown. And they all kind of stumble out on stage for the very first thing. And they just look lost. Their eyes are. And I come out and I kind of look drunk. And I start to do the bit. And I'm saying it. And the audience completely, because it was fans of ours,
mm-hmm.
completely got where I was going. Oh, my God. This is more than a box. And then I couldn't remember. And I went in the store and they gave me this box. And they God, who took my cigarettes? I had cigarettes in here. Jesus Christ, I don't know what to have. And so I'm kind of lost now, and I'm thinking about what I had in the box. Mm-hmm. And they start wandering off and just lose interest and you know, staggering off.
Sure.
And then I finally just drop the box, and I don't know, and go off.
Holy shit.
And it was great.
That's so
good.
It was
really great.
Mm-hmm.
Then we ended with more than a box for the very last
still
time.
Still did it. I love it. Good God.
But it was a really good little film.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to have to get that. That sounds phenomenal. I also like the idea of being committed to going out on a high and being fortunate enough to do it. That's amazing.
If that last show had sucked, oh my God, that would have been, okay, you guys, what do we do? We have to do another one.
Yeah, right,
right. Can't go out like that. Yeah, it was a good one.
If that's now and if that's satisfactory for you, I know that there are people who are clearly either due to money or due to compulsion can't stop getting together and doing the kind of shit with their old buddies. What is it to you? What is that group to you as a part of your life? Is it just like, this was a really creative period for me? I love it.
Oh,
and I'm fine keeping it where it is.
Oh no, I'm gonna look at my watch, not because of I'm looking at the time.
Uh-huh.
I'm looking at my blood sugar,
uh-huh. Oh.
Which I'm not happy where it is.
Oh, okay.
It's been a long day. So I'm going to take a shot with uh-huh. my little Omnipod here.
We can take a break if you like.
No.
Okay,
no, I can
fine.
Do this while we talk.
All right.
I just program in my blood sugar, and then I go, yes. And mm-hmm. it says, are you going to eat now? No. Oh, confirm. And it's telling me I'm going to give me 1.70 units, but I'm going to say, no, you're going to give me 4.70 units. And then that's that.
More than a box.
More than a box. More than a thing.
Mm-hmm.
Duck's Breath saved my life.
Yeah.
I was the worst student that ever fucking lived.
Uh-huh.
When I was in high school, I had my senior year of high school, I had two study halls. Out of six periods of the day, two of them were study halls.
Uh-huh.
Sitting in the cafeteria, shooting the shit with people.
Yeah.
And supposedly studying, but never once studying.
Of course.
And I dropped a class and I was going to pick up another study hall. But I went, wait a minute. I don't know that I'll graduate. If I take half my classes or study halls,
mm-hmm.
I probably won't graduate. Mm,
right.
Then my girlfriend told me she was going to go to Iowa State University. And I wanted to go to wherever she was going.
Sure.
I didn't want to go to college. I didn't care about anything. But I wanted to go where she was. And so I went up and met with the registrar, and I'm really smooth. I can sort of, you know, look like I know what I'm talking
sure.
about, kind of. And I went and met with the registrar and told him how interested I was in coming to Iowa State, blah, blah, blah. And all you have to do is be a resident of the state of Iowa and be in the top half of your graduating class. Mm. And I went, the top half? Are you kidding? Of course I am.
Mm-hmm.
Jeez. I mean, look at the people I go to high school with. Are you telling me I'm in the bottom half? Of course I am. So I go back to Hoover High School, and I go to the registrar, and I say, I need to find out where I am in our graduating class per my grades right now. So I come back in an hour, and she tells me I'm in the bottom quarter of my graduating class.
Shit.
I went, what are you talking about? I mean, I looked out in the hall going, those people? Those people are getting better grades than me. I really thought I was, I don't know what I thought. I was uh-huh. an idiot. But I was a terrible student, and I couldn't get into Iowa State. So I had to go to a junior college mm-hmm. to get my grades up. I went to a junior college, and my grades went down.
Oh, no.
And then I just started traveling. And I went to Europe. I went on a bicycle. I moved to Vermont. I just started traveling as much as I could. And I loved traveling. I had a great time. There was no sense of what. Stop it. That's this thing. Then I end up, because I'm diabetic, mm-hmm. I ended up getting a scholarship from vocational rehabilitation at University of Iowa.
All right.
To go to school. They sent me to school. This is years later. And because I was type 1 diabetic. And they did that so that I didn't end up with a blue-collar job where I'd chop my toes off.
Yeah, right, right.
And I didn't know what I wanted to do. I mean, every class I signed up for, I would tell them I had a different major so I didn't have to take all the classes. I went to school. I went to college for 5 semesters. I am still a freshman.
Really?
5 semesters, 2.5 years. I'm still a freshman. And just stop beeping. And with a D average. I'm also a distinguished alumni from the University of Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
And when we got these things because of Duck's Breath, they made us distinguished alumni. And I went up, and all the guys in the group have MFAs. One guy has 2 MFAs.
Holy shit.
And I went up, and we all got to make a little speech. And all these people were getting them. You know, there were mm-hmm. people that wrote books about their family coming, descending from slaves, a guy who did DNA testing, and we're all distinguished alumni. And I went, I gotta be the only guy up here who's still a freshman. Anybody with a D average? Anybody? So I didn't know what I was going to do. I really didn't. And I didn't, I just enjoyed bumping around and doing nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And Duck's Breath completely saved my life. You know, they gave me a focus. I could do what we were trying to do without really knowing. I didn't know how to act. I didn't know how to write.
Mm-hmm.
But now I'm working with guys who are, you know, actors. Mm-hmm. They're really good actors. They're MFAs in playwriting.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm kind of learning by just osmosis, by being yeah. next to them, watching. Well, why can't I say that? Because, Jim, it doesn't make any sense. We need to have something here where this, whatever. But I learned. I transferred that to Two-Headed Dog.
Mm-hmm.
And whereas I used to be the guy in the group that was like, whoa, I don't know what that guy's doing, but that was something.
Mm-hmm.
It was fun to watch, but does he know what he's doing? You know, I was the nutball.
Yeah.
I was the loose fringe. And then we started Two-Headed Dog, and then I became the kind of uptight guy that all the guys in Duck's Breath were, and Mark Fight got to be the nutball. And it really, it was like, fuck this. You motherfucker. But now we've kind of worked it out, so we go back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
And we each get to be the nutball.
It's not often you hear that sketch comedy saves somebody's life, but that's really nice to hear. That's amazing. I love that doing that was that much.
Completely.
That important.
It gave me, it didn't just save my life. It gave me a life.
Yeah.
It gave me a life that, first of all, I love doing it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had problems. I was a petulant little crybaby about many different things
mm-hmm.
In our touring years, but I also loved it. You know, when we did shows, I knew how to perform. I knew how to, you know, wring laughs from an audience. Mm-hmm. And so here was a chance to just do it.
What was it like? I'm sorry, I'm skipping all over the place.
That's all right.
But what was it like the first time you had your own record? Did that mean anything to you?
Kind of.
Yeah.
It was weird. Like this first record,
mm-hmm.
which we took illegally. This is the Palace of Fine Arts in San Francisco, and there's a pond. And we dressed up in those outfits.
Holy shit.
And wandered out wearing, you know, big hip waiter boots.
Amazing.
And then every once in a while, someone would come out going, what are you doing? And we would all come in, wait for that guy to leave, and then we'd all wander back out to take those. I wasn't a big comedy listener.
Okay.
That's not totally true. Bill Cosby. I listened to Bill Cosby.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What are you going
to
do?
That is one of the biggest
mm-hmm.
heartbreakers to me of all these people that, you know, one by one
mm-hmm.
become this national embarrassment. Woody Allen. I always liked Woody Allen movies, but I didn't. Jewish friends of mine that are really into comedy worshipped. It was like, are mm-hmm. you kidding me?
Mm-hmm.
They just loved Woody Allen.
Of course.
And they are heartbroken. Mm-hmm. They're heartbroken.
Yeah.
Bill Cosby, I just thought he was the funniest thing in the world.
Of course, yeah.
And for him to be beyond despicable, mm-hmm. I mean, he's just like repulsive.
Yeah.
And it,
I
dumb
know.
Shit. So yeah, this is 1980.
Uh-huh.
It was a big deal. I mean, it was really great, but mm-hmm. it didn't.
I mean, was it a sales tool for you guys, too? Like it is for like a lot of stand-ups?
That's all it was, yeah. It was something that we could sell
mm-hmm.
at shows. We always had T-shirts.
Mm-hmm.
And T-shirts, you know, made a ton of money.
Yeah,
T-shirts, were great.
Of course. Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's perfect timing.
And the record was another thing to sell. Mm-hmm. And it was another thing then you buy it and then we'd sign it.
Yeah.
Oh, can we get the guys to sign it? Yeah.
Of course.
So that was good. We had 45s out before this. We put a 45 out with When Girls Collide.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote a song called When Girls Collide with this guy, Tim Barrett. That's a song sung by a woman who does roller derby.
Uh-huh.
And everybody thinks it's fake, and they call her a fake. And and it's like she's singing it while she's all bruised and beat up. And it's, are you kidding? You know? The shoestrings are giving me trouble tonight. The wheels won't roll like they should. My skirt is bloody from last night's fight. I'd quit this job if I could. When girls collide, it's a roller derby massacre. Was she on your side? Number 14, her name was Janie Zer. Something, my uniform's broke. I can't. The Daily News is calling us fakes. I can't remember the rest of the words.
Who's singing it on the album?
Me.
It is you. Yeah. I didn't know. See, that this is...
And I can't sing. You know, I wasn't a singer. I later had a band called Boomer that we were together about 8 years, that I was the lead singer in Boomer. And again, I can't sing. I don't know how to hit notes. I don't know what... And everybody else in the band sung like angels. They really did. They sang harmonies. I don't know how to sing a harmony.
Mm-hmm.
If you're singing a harmony with me, my voice will go find the note that you're singing and sing it.
Uh-huh.
And I can't stay. So when Duck's Breath sang harmonies, which we did a lot, I would always have to stand next to somebody and sing what they were singing, because I could do that. So when we had Boomer, I had to look, if there was any part that wasn't just like, you know, verse, chorus, bridge, if there was something funky, like after the chorus, we're going to go two lines and then we're going to come back into the chorus.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean? Two lines, where do those, because I could know where the verse was.
Yeah.
I know the verse is this long. What do you mean two lines? Where do I come in then? You come in, Jim will point at you. And the drummer on stage would, we'd be doing this. Don't Cry Myra had this tricky little thing, and I would turn around while they're singing the backup, and he would go bum bam and point right at me with his drumstick.
Oh my God.
And I would go, Don't Cry Myra.
Holy shit.
Because I never learned any of that stuff. Mm-hmm. I never learned anything.
Yeah.
I'm an ignoramus. I'm not proud of it.
I don't know. Self-taught comedy's not so bad though. I mean, it's a skill, and it's not just a skill, but it's to turn that also into being a working actor is not half bad.
And I didn't really know how to, for a long time, I didn't know how to recapture the thing that, because when I was in high school, and junior high and high school, it was like a, I keep hitting this
I keep doing the same thing.
It was like a magical thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't really have close friends, but I could get into a thing where I could start making people laughing.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would just go. And I didn't really know what I was doing. And I would just keep doing it and keep doing it.
Yeah.
And then whenever I did that, I always noticed everybody split up right afterwards. Like nobody wanted to go like hang out with me.
Mm-hmm.
They just kind of disappeared. Like, okay, we don't know what that was that we just saw.
Okay.
And I always felt like, how come I'm doing this so that you'll be my friend.
Right.
So you'll run away. Mm-hmm. But they really would. They'd go, whoo. But I knew how to entertain.
Yeah.
But I didn't know how to recreate, like, whatever it was I'd just done.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a good stand-up would go, okay, the joke was here.
Mm-hmm.
The setup is here. They would figure that out. Mm-hmm. I never learned how to do that.
Yeah.
And Duck's Breath helped me do that a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Like now, you know, like when I do Randy, I know exactly where, and I know exactly where to increase it and, you know, add a bit.
Mm-hmm. So you say you listen to some comedy albums. We went over the Cosby stuff. Was there any other stuff that was in the house or that you picked up as a kid yourself? Were your parents funny? Did they have stuff sitting around?
My dad could be funny, but he didn't. It wasn't like a big. It wasn't a big thing.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody, I think, appreciated stuff, but it wasn't. My brother's very funny, but he's younger. Yeah, I didn't. You know, Jerry Lewis, though I didn't have any of his records growing up,
right.
But I worshipped him. I mean, I really did. I worshipped Jerry Lewis.
Yep.
And the reason I became a fan, the first record I ever bought was Jerry Lewis and the Playboys, This Diamond Ring.
Okay.
And the reason I bought it was that it's Gary is Jerry's son.
Mm-hmm.
This will have to be genius.
Mm-hmm.
And it is genius. I love This Diamond Ring.
Uh-huh.
But I love Jerry Lewis movies. And my folks had seen Dean and Jerry at the K&T Theater in Des Moines, Iowa, and were blown away by it. That's and this great. Was like I was, they were, I wasn't born yet.
Uh-huh.
But they said that was like crazy.
I can't imagine.
Just insane. You know, Jerry was in the audience crawling around on chairs and.
Holy shit.
And then I went to see Jerry a couple times. I've seen his live show twice.
Mm-hmm.
Not anymore, of course.
Sure.
But one was in Vegas,
mm-hmm.
and I was in Vegas doing an Arliss episode, and I stayed over an extra night just so I could see the Jerry Lewis show.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the most egotistical, arrogant, sometimes brilliantly funny,
mm-hmm.
And he wasn't doing the thing that I... Later, he would just come out and sit in a giant chair, in a big director's chair, and tell stories that he read off a monitor and then answer questions. But when he still was walking around, this would have been 2000, something like that.
Uh-huh.
You go into the theater, you're listening to Jerry Lewis sing.
Uh-huh.
The tape that you're listening to as you get your seat for 40 minutes...
Mm-hmm.
is Jerry Lewis singing songs. Then the show starts at 8 o'clock.
Uh-huh.
Boom.
On the button.
No opening act. Jerry comes out, does an hour and a half of Jerry, and then the second it's over, there's no encore.
Mm-hmm.
Immediately, Jerry Lewis music starts again. So it's like, whoa. And he did bits. Some of them were shocking and how horrible that racist they were.
Uh-huh.
He did this bit about how Chinese people name their kids and they drop a handful of silverware onto a silver tray.
Yep.
And he goes, poing chang tong bang tong poing chang tong.
Holy shit.
And I went, oh. Oh my God. Does he realize it's 2000? Oh my God.
Holy crap.
But then he also did some brilliant things. You know, uh-huh. There's this bit where he drops a cane into the audience and he makes some old guy, hey, can you grab that? And then the guy picks it up and hands it to him and starts to walk away. And as soon as he turns, Jerry drops it. And then the guy sits down and he's just standing there. And it's, you can see this joke coming a mile away.
Sure.
It's still funny. Yeah. It's really funny. He did a little bit of answering questions, not much. He played some brilliant tapes, you know, brilliant bits, the thing with the pencils and the office. Then when I saw him years later down in South Coast somewhere, he answered questions. He sat in his chair. People lined up on either side on the aisles.
Mm-hmm.
And one by one were abused by him.
Oh, no.
And some of it was stunning.
Uh-huh.
This woman came up and was in tears, and she had a book. And she went, Jerry, I have to tell you, I was a little girl, and my father was the craft service guy on I can't remember what movie, but some movie. And I used to see you every day. I would go and I would hang out with my father and at the craft service table, and we would see you, and he just adored you. He just adored you. And he lives in Connecticut, and I'm just wondering, he's not doing well. He's in the hospital there, and I was just wondering, is there any way? And she had his book, one of his books,
uh-huh.
you know, is there any way that I could get you to sign this? No, thank you. Next.
Holy shit.
And she's standing there holding this book up for him to see. Next. And then he turns to the other aisle on the other side of the stage. And she's going, but I, and he said, I said, next, ma'am. And then somebody came down and touched her shoulder and she was gone.
Oh.
It was, we went with like 15 people.
Uh-huh.
And we all looked at each other like, oh my God, that is as cold as it gets.
Uh-huh.
Another guy came up and as soon as he, and so you have a question? I do. Hey, lady. Boom, gone. You know, just drag him out. That I understood.
Uh-huh.
But can you please sign my book for my dad? Next. No, next.
Oh, my God. Wow. I mean, I'm not surprised, yet I am. Like, that is the, wow.
You ever seen that interview he does with somebody? It was on YouTube. Some guy went, and he didn't, I don't know if he, the questions were a little weird,
uh-huh.
But he was trying to set him up so mm-hmm. that Jerry could look great, and he just abused him horribly. He was horribly mean.
What was going on?
Horrible human being.
Yeah, yeah.
But boy, did I like him. Him and Bill Cosby, what does it tell you? Holy shit.
Well, we all loved
him. And Woody Allen.
Yeah, right, right. What are you going to do?
Am I just a piece of shit?
I'm the sloth who thinks Take the Money and Run is the best thing Woody Allen ever did, and people probably don't like hearing that, but that's fine. It's a great movie. It's a brilliant movie.
Yeah, it was.
We should just remake it. Is that possible? Let's just remake it so it's no longer associated. You know, that's my thought. You know, Greg Fitzsimmons goes around doing Bill Cosby's jokes just to reclaim them a little bit. I like the shit out of that.
He does?
Yes. Every once in a while he'll do Bill Cosby's bits, and I'm like, well, that's one way to make that art a little less, you know, saturated with gross.
Oh, I've played in tournaments with Greg Fitzsimmons.
Have you?
Yeah. Golf tournaments.
I've actually, he's made me, I was thinking this before I even knew he did that. I've always wanted to do a show where comedians cover other comedians' work because it's not a thing you do because it's weird. It's joke stealing if you don't announce it, but if you announce it ahead of time, you know, I'd want to get,
you
know.
If it's a tribute, that's great.
Right? Yeah.
If you just do it,
yes.
Then, wait.
Yeah.
Did you just, I know that joke. Did you steal that?
Right.
What
would you do if there's a bit that you could do?
Well, it's funny because I'm actually talking to this woman. It's not really a bit because mm-hmm. I'm not a big stand-up guy. Besides Bill Cosby stuff, I don't really know. You'd have to throw names at
sure,
me.
Sure, sure, sure.
And I go, oh, yeah, I know that.
Mm-hmm.
But I wasn't a big stand-up guy.
Mm-hmm.
I tried to develop a stand-up act called The 29-Year-Old Man, and it just, I couldn't figure out how to write jokes.
Mm-hmm.
Like those kind of jokes.
Yeah.
Jokes. But tribute-wise, there's this performer in New York named Deb Margolin. And now she's more of a playwright
mm-hmm.
and several award-winning plays. She wrote a play about Madoff that was in New York, L.A., where, I don't know. Fantastic. But her solo stuff is just wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
Just wonderful. She did this bit where she got a message on her answering machine, and clearly it was a wrong number,
mm-hmm.
but this person left her a 10-minute long message about all this different stuff. And so she comes out and she plays it. She goes, I got this message the other day on my answering machine. And she plays it, and we listen to it. And then she goes, so, and it's really evocative.
Uh-huh.
You know, there's numbers talked about. There's a thing, a meeting or something. And she tries to break it down. Who this person is,
uh-huh.
What is it they're trying to say? It was really cool. But almost everything she did was unique and wonderful. And there's a place that she and I both perform in New York called Dixon Place.
Mm-hmm.
And I've done a lot of shows at Dixon Place. And I said to her, Deb, let's do a show, a benefit for Dixon Place, where it's Deb Margolin and Jim Turner as Deb Margolin and Jim Turner. Or as Jim Turner and Deb Margolin.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll do each other's bits.
I love it.
And we'll do it, you know, we'll have scripts.
Mm-hmm.
You can do a script.
Sure.
But you'll wear the costumes that I always wear. Whatever. And she wasn't big into costumes, but I'll wear whatever you were going to wear.
Mm-hmm. I love that so much.
Oh, I would love to do it.
That was technically said to vibrate. I don't know how that happened.
Is my 10 on vibrate.
Yeah, but it's fine. Wow, that was fun. What was that? It's a 10-minute mark? Okay, good. That is fantastic. I'm so glad that somebody's actually doing something like that. And but the two of you get to bounce back and forth.
I hope we do it. I really hope we do it.
That'd be great.
When I proposed it to Ellie Covan, the woman who runs Dicks in Place, I said, what if Deb and I did this thing? She went, oh, my God. I would love that.
That's brilliant.
I would love that.
I love it so much.
So we'll see.
Normally towards the end of an album an episode, we recommend, hey, why would you recommend listening to this album? Would you recommend people seek this weird shit out that you've collected if they could somehow find it?
If you can find a copy of Music from Another Planet, I don't want to say I'll come to your house and blow you, but what's the second best thing? That would be, I don't know that there is another.
I wonder. I can tell you for sure, Taylor, my friend Taylor, who recommended you to me, will want to hear that and clean it up himself. I'll put money on it. If I tell him about it,
tell him
he's going to hunt you down and ask you to borrow
tell
it.
Tell him. Give him my info.
I will.
Yeah, the Richard Peterson stuff, these aren't like the go. You know, you can find Mr. Tremendous Speaks, everyone listens, online, but you really got to search for it because I've seen it for sale.
Yes, I did see that.
And I know that other people have seen it in it, what I saw in it, because the new LSD, that's just fantastic. But as far as just like easy comedy listening, they're not
right.
The Duck's Breath albums are
absolutely.
The second one's pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
The Boogaloo Players is very funny. Yeah, I can't think of, like, what do I listen to comedy-wise audio now?
I do it because I forced myself to, you see.
Yeah.
You know, I love comedy albums, and then I realize, oh, I really have to stick to that.
Yeah.
Last year, I tried to listen to a comedy album a day. I got a third of the way.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, most of them are shit. People are tired of hearing me say that, but most of them are garbage. There's a reason you only hear people asking, oh, can we talk about George Carlin's Class Clown? That's that, or Let's Get Small by Steve Martin. Those are the two almost everybody picks. And it's can't do it again. Can't do it again. They're my favorites. Can't do it again.
Yeah.
It's hard. It's if you don't listen to comedy.
Here's a funny Steve Martin story.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was the first time he played The Boarding House, where I think he recorded a live record. The first time he played there, the other guys, Duxbeth used to be an ongoing opening act at the boarding house.
Okay.
And we've actually performed the very last night of the boarding house.
Wow.
We were the last thing in the boarding house. And we could go to any shows for free. So everybody went to see Steve Martin. We'd heard stories about him and, you know, there'd been, you know, newspaper articles. I think there'd been a thing in Rolling Stone by then. And everybody went to see him. And then they came back and they went, oh, my God. Oh, my God, Jim, you have to go. You have to go.
Mm-hmm.
It's unreal. He's a god. And so I went the next night. And it blew my mind.
Of course.
It just blew my mind. And I went backstage because we were able to go backstage then. And he's in his dressing room, this shitty little dressing room in the boarding house. And I came in. I said, hey, my name's Jim Turner. That was amazing. I'm in a comedy group called Duck's Breath. And I was going to tell him we have a show tomorrow night at the other cafe. And I started to say that because that's one of the things we talked about was if there's any way we can get him to see us.
Of course.
If there's any way. And I said, and, you know, the rest of my group came last night. And he goes, oh, yeah. They gave me a flyer. And he looks around and there's a wadded up piece of paper on the floor of his dressing room. And he goes, yeah, they gave me a flyer. Here it is. And he unfolds it. And it was Duck's Breath at the cafe. Crumpled up. And I went, oh, wow. Yes, that's our flyer. You want another one or will that one do? He said, no, I don't think I can come, but.
Holy shit, that's so good.
Oh, yeah, your group was here. Yeah, they where's that flyer? Yeah, here. I wish there'd been a cigarette burn in it.
Right. That's what I was expecting. So that's phenomenal. Oh, my God. Perfect. I don't know when this is going to come out, so I apologize. I don't have the schedule in front of me, but is there anything that you need to promote coming up soon? Anywhere people should go online to find all your stuff?
You know what would be great is if Two-Headed Dog had a website that you could go and look at it.
Mm-hmm.
There is a thing called twoheadeddog.com, and if you go there, you can see shows that we did 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the last time we entered anything into it. I don't think Mark or I know the password or how to get into it.
Mm-hmm.
The woman that we hired to run it hasn't worked for us for a long time. We have a Facebook page.
Okay.
We have Two-Headed Dog Facebook. We don't have any shows coming up because basically we lost the Steve Allen Theater.
Yes, right.
There's talk of a new place called the Hayworth.
Okay.
On Wilshire, the Hayworth Theater.
All right.
That's trying to, I think, take a bunch of that Steve Allen stuff.
That'd be good.
Because it has a built-in audience.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't have any, there's no, nothing coming up.
Yeah. Okay.
There will be.
Yes.
But not yet.
Well, then people should definitely go to the Facebook page.
Yeah.
Check it out. Like it. All that good shit. Good.
Yeah.
Well, this has been super fun. I'd be happy to have you back on if there's another album you want to talk about.
Okay.
Or another pile of them. I don't give a shit.
Okay.
This has been super fun.
All right, good. And yeah, I had a blast.
I've kept you way too long, but...
I will go through my records and see whether...
Please do.
Whether the junk I have.
This was so much fun, and I don't have... You know what? People just go to bit.ly/comedy albums, and you'll go to my sort of tiny little comedy record label. That's about it. Thank you guys for listening, and as always, have a good thing. Comedy on Vinyl is a production of Stolen Dress Entertainment. It is produced by Mike Warden and is hosted and edited by Jason Klom. Our theme song was composed and performed by Richard Levinson. Please visit stolendress.com to listen to our other podcasts, read our blogs, read our tweets, watch our videos, and read our books. Please subscribe on iTunes, and if you like us, give us a 5-star rating and a nice review. You can find us on facebook.com/comedyonvinyl, Twitter @comedyonvinyl, and find everything else at comedyonvinyl.com. A major portion of Comedy on Vinyl has been underwritten by Stand Up Records. Please visit standuprecords.com for all your comedy needs and tune into the new Stand Up channel available on the Roku, where you can also find select episodes of this podcast.